And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hey folks, welcome into On to Waveland. It's the Cubs podcast here at The Athletic. I'm Brett Taylor, joined by Sahadev Sharma and Patrick Mooney. We are reeling, just reeling, knowing that the Cubs cannot take home the Crosstown Cup. Did you know that? No, no one knows that. But you see, if you tie, the Cup stays with the previous team. So having lost both of these games, the Cubs now can no longer take the Cup. Isn't it amazing that nobody is talking about that? Nobody immediately after last night's loss was like dropping the bomb of like, no, the Cubs can't win the Cup now.
It's the most romantic trophy in baseball because Patrick and I and other writers witnessed a proposal right next to the Cup yesterday. We were. Is it still called a cup? Crosstown Cup?
Yeah, it's not really it's not like a cup anymore.
I'm not sure.
It's kind of
It's not what it used to be. It's like a building almost.
Yeah.
Kind of like a Lego mini skyscraper type thing.
The Crosstown Block.
Yeah.
Did you get context?
She said yes. Yeah. She said yes.
Okay. So did you get context for the proposal? Was it like a White Sox fan and a Cubs fan or?
No, I don't know. I think we were all just a little taken aback that was the venue for the proposal. But hey, you know.
We're all looking at each other and the security guards, are kind of like nodding along like, no, that's a proposal. Like everyone saw it and it took a moment to like sink in and then the. Said yes, so wishing them many years of happiness ahead, watching Cubs, White Sox, Crosstown Thrillers.
Well, I proposed to my wife in front of like the, the Paul Bunyan axe or the jug, the big jug, all those ones that are actually historical. And I think if I had proposed to her in front of the Crosstown Cup, she might have said no. I think that might have been it for us.
Yeah.
So, okay. So the Cubs, as we joke, they did, of course, lose last night to the White Sox and the night before. I don't want to echo everything that we said last week, but, you know, primarily what was notable to me is like the things that you would have written down on paper going into the series that were like, oh, I'm kind of concerned about this against this matchup. Blah, blah, blah. It's what played out. I mean, Kopech and Giolito got their strikeouts. That White Sox bullpen is very strong. The Cubs, for their part, we'll get into it in a moment, but they had to use an opener in the first game and then Kyle Hendricks in the second game. And Kyle Hendricks did kind of what he's done the last couple of years, which is look not terrible, but you know, he kind of looked like he looks. And then you get the results and you're like, oh, these results aren't very good. Is this normal now? And whatever. We're going to have plenty of weeks left to get into Kyle Hendricks, and I don't know that he was the most compelling.
I didn't think he was that bad, but.
Well, you just forced, like, that's all it takes. I was like, I'm not going to get into it. You said that. He wasn't that bad. And if you looked at, like, the pitch location, it was much better than it's been in his bad outings. I understand that the two decisive runs came on that bullshit grounder through the shift and then that blooping bullshit in the outfield. I get it. At the same time, he struck out two, a lot of balls in play, a lot of really hard contact that was not all on the ground. I don't know. I thought it looked, that's why I try to describe it as I'm like, it looked, you know, like, oh yeah, that's Kyle Hendricks. But then you look at the results and you're like, but these results are bad. So is that just what he is now? So anyway, like I said, we'll get into that more. And I do think it's reasonable to give more time for him to continue working and adjusting before we conclude that like the last 2 years are the trend, you know, but setting that aside, I thought you know, the things that I noticed in this series, and we'll get into it, the strikeouts, which really started to accelerate last week and continued into this matchup. And it was your piece, right? Sahadev, okay. So we'll get into that. Sahadev has a particular take on the looking strikes, which there's just no way you haven't noticed by now if you've been watching. But Dap to the bullpen, I mean, it keeps doing its thing, including the first game of the series. Drew Smyly went on the bereavement list, so Scott Efros was tapped to be the opener. He two unearned runs because of defensive shenanigans behind him, but I thought he looked just as capable as ever. Keegan Thompson with the bulk behind him looked like Keegan Thompson, and so that was good. I wanted to give love to Efros for that because it was just another example of, like, he just kind of quietly does whatever the situation is, whatever's asked. And I don't know if you've looked at any of the quality of contact leaderboards at StatCast, but he's like in the top five of everything. So he's, you know, the crappy balls in play off of him are, or the results that are the product of crappy balls in play are deserved. And just a wonderful story. I like, Sahadev was telling us before we started recording that he was doing a radio hit on Dan Bernstein's show on The Score, and I'll let you take it from there. Just you can share a brief version of that, but I wanted to make sure to be like, plug The Score, because you don't want to steal the story. Just there you go.
No, it was we talk about Efros a lot. Like, he's a student of the game. Really seems like a really down to earth guy off the mound, and really kind to everyone, and this story kind of blew me away, but apparently Dan Bernstein's son started throwing sidearm at the recommendation of a coach, and Dan obviously knows Ian Happ because Ian Happ comes on their show weekly. He reached out to Happ and asked if he could get Scott Efros's email, expecting a very, you know, like, minor response, you know, something nice for a kid, right? Efros asks for video of his son, and then doesn't just like give a quick breakdown, but gets on the phone with his kid for like 40 minutes and talks about pitching with him, and then tells him, you can reach out to me anytime. And knowing Efros, you know, I've known him since whenever he came up last season, so it's not like I have this great long history with the dude, but just knowing what we know about him, I wouldn't be surprised if he responds to those texts frequently and encourages the kid to, like, really means it when he tells the kid to reach out. He's a fascinating story, as, you know, a lot of people have written about how he got here, but he's the type of guy that doesn't seem like it's going to be a quick flash in the pan for him. Guys that throw the way he does can last a really long time, like, as Gibbons is showing, as Darren O'Day shows, as Joe Smith shows. Like, there's a lot of guys like this that he could carve out a long career for himself.
Two quick things on Efros. One, from a statistical point to what you were saying there about his ability to keep doing this, he throws from the most extreme third base side release point in baseball. He's the single most extreme. And we remember that, or that... maybe this is a bad point to make, but if you'll recall, there was a period of time when Kyle Ryan was the same on the first base side. The delivery wasn't the same, so it's not a comp in that respect. But, like, guys who do super extreme things can sometimes surprise you. And so, you know, I dig that. And also, hearing this story about Efros was not, I mean, it's amazing, but it's not super surprising, because everything you hear about him from everybody who interacts with him is that he's just a super good dude. And it made me think about, like you said, his particular story and trajectory as a college starting pitching prospect who was drafted kind of late, who I don't want to say he immediately flamed out, but there wasn't a ton of upward development there as soon as he got into the system. And, you know, as the story goes, he was essentially told, you know, maybe you should try screwing around with your sidearm thing, because I'm not sure that this is going to work for you otherwise. And so I translate that to stories that I hear about him talking to Bernstein's kid. And just, you wonder to what extent he's like, you know, I got a total second chance and it elevated me to the big leagues. And I want to try to pass on that spirit, not the sidearm thing, but that spirit of, like, helping people on to as many people as I can. And I just, that story, it just, I don't know, it tickled me just right, in the right way, when you were telling it. So I appreciate that. I mean, it's sincere. I come off so bad when I'm being sincere, because I swear, in my real life, I am like this deeply sincere, affected person. But anytime I'm doing like content, whether it's a podcast or writing or whatever, I have to be like, no, I'm being sincere. I mean this. Did you guys see the Blue Jays fan who caught the Aaron Judge home run and gave it to the kid behind him in the Aaron Judge shirt? I mean, just, and the kid melts and weeps. I cried. I was watching that and I cried. I'm not ashamed. It was so touching. And so I just like the story with the Efros thing, I guess it's kids. Kids, it kind of gets to me a bit, but it just makes me so happy, and it makes me feel like, all right, we got some goodness out there. There's some goodness out there. All right.
Nobody has kind of like baseball, though. This is like the Oprah episode.
Yeah.
Avanta Waveland.
Yeah.
Of,
only if you look under your
faking sincerity, hey, and
look under your chair, Patrick. You will find everybody's getting some spider tack. You get some spider tack, and you get some spider tack.
Okay.
Speaking of that,
I'm just trying to figure out how we transition.
Well, I'm just going to keep bouncing.
The
did you see
feel good
the Madison Bumgarner hand check? Did you guys see this, where he was getting hand checked after his first inning, and the umpire, there had to have been, you know, that there was something to that, because the umpire was just like staring deeply into Bumgarner's eyes as he is very slowly checking his hand. And so Bumgarner is already predisposed to a little red-assery, and dude, ump had to know that he was going to say something. He just totally baited the guy. And so Bumgarner says something, immediately gets ejected, and there's this big flap or whatever. And see, there was, let me see, how can I circle this back to the Cubs? No ejections for the Cubs recently. Yes, nailed it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the strike zone. the strike zone issues with the Cubs, specifically this. I like a lot of the quotes that you got, Sadiv, that were kind of speaking to this issue that, like, philosophically, the Cubs may have the right idea. Insofar as, you know, we've heard this before. Early on, you want to target something specifically that you want to attack, a pitch type and a pitch location. And when you get behind in the count, then you can kind of sort of become a little more defensive. And that may be what the Cubs are trying to employ, but we aren't seeing a lot of success early in the counts. Like maybe a decent amount of swings, although you found they were taking a lot of early strikes compared to other teams. A lot of fouling it back. They get behind. And then we're just seeing this inordinate volume of, you know what it looks like when a guy thought he was going to get this pitch And instead he got that pitch and it's like, ah, shit. You, like, you can see it registering for him. Ah, shit. I was wrong on that. You might see that once or twice a week total. But like, I feel like we're seeing it every game for at least one guy that particular moment. And I'm just like, what is up with that?
Yeah, it ended the eighth and ninth inning, right? I mean, Ian Happ, who's been really good about not about his swing decisions and like, he's probably been one of the best of the group. So that was uncharacteristic for him. But he was hammered with four pitches up in the zone, two changeups, I think, and two fastballs. And then it was Matt Foster, right? Matt Foster threw a fastball down in the zone that just completely caught Happ off guard, and he took it for a strike. To end the game, Nico, you know, I think he was expecting a breaking ball there with two strikes and just took a fastball down the middle. Way too many looking strikes. And part of it is talking to Ross, talking to Greg Brown. Okay, you want to swing at the right pitches, right? You don't want to take you can take some strikes. There are strikes that you should take. There are 50-50 pitches that go that the umpire one day will call a strike, the next umpire the next day will call a ball. If you take those on a 0-0 count or a 2-0 count, fine. Look for your pitch. But they're taking the second highest percentage of what StatCast defines as strikes in the heart of the zone, the second highest percentage of those pitches. That's the problem right there. You can't take those pitches that you're supposed to be attacking. I didn't write all of this just because I wanted to focus on the takes, but they're chasing again and they're not swinging at the pitches in the zone. So they're swinging at the since the start of the Rays series, the strikeout rate has jumped to top in baseball, and they're chasing more. The contact is down. The swinging at pitches in the zone is way down. The swinging strikes in general are way up. So it's not just looking at pitches. It's just I think the Michael Kopech said this, and so did Ross. They're in between. They're guessing wrong, and it's really hard. I mean, we've talked about this before with all-star players who say the same thing. Sometimes you just, you know, the guy on the mound just outthinks you, outpitches you, and takes advantage of the situation. And I think right now there's a lot of things off with them, and things are not going well. What I found interesting, Eno Saris just published a piece today about how there's essentially like the best way to get good offense is to not swing as much. So the Cubs are halfway there. they just need to make the right swing decisions when they do swing.
I got to tell you, if not swinging the bat a superstar makes, then the Cubs need to hit me up, because I will stand there and I will stand in the far back corner of the box and I will not swing. And I do. I always wonder, I'm like, what would your walk rate be? You know, because obviously the pitcher knows, okay, this tiny, skinny dweeb is not going to swing, but sometimes they miss. I bet I might have like a 100 on base percentage, which is just fantastic.
Could be playable. Yeah.
Oh, and not only would I have that, also my defense would be terrible. So you'd get that too.
Well, that's helpful.
I've just been surprised. Like, I was thinking about this after reading Sade's piece. Like, you kind of look around the diamond up and down the lineup, like the Cubs have been reasonably pleased with their catching tandem. Nico's looked good at shortstop. I think we've talked about this before on the podcast. Like, Patrick Wisdom has like unique skill set and he makes very little money. Like, it plays. Ian Happ yesterday, David Ross described him as the team MVP. We knew Seiya Suzuki would have an adjustment period, and he's looks pretty rough now, but he's certainly shown flashes of being an impact hitter in the majors. And yet still we're talking about the offense again, and the Cubs are among the worst teams in baseball, and the season is pretty much over in early May. Like, they've had a lot of things, you know, kind of go right on the position player side. Obviously, there's been some misses thus far. It's just surprising to me that if, you know, we kind of talked about this right before the season started, like all these things would happen. Like, where do you think the Cubs would be? I don't think we would have said like totally buried. And that's kind of where they are after this series.
Yeah. And you, all of that plays. And then we always have to grip ourselves with the caution of, you know, for as swiftly as they've fallen after that 6-4 start, it's like, okay, it's only been 14 games since then, which is more than half the season so far. So it's like, but it's also like, okay, is that really enough to say, you know, that, okay, we've had confirmed what our suspicions were. And I don't know, I always fight that battle a bit, and I try not to. I sort of am questioning myself. I'm like, how much am I doing that because I'm a fan and I'm like talking myself into having that tiny bit of hope, and that, oh, there's big changes that they're making that will take time to take root. And we start digging into a topic like this where it's like, okay, you know, they do have a new hitting coach, and they do have a lot of new players, and they do have kind of a philosophy shift, and on and on. And maybe it'll take a little time. Maybe it takes some game action to bear fruit. I don't know. I leave myself open to those possibilities, but at the same time, you know, we're all watching the same games, and it is hard to, you know, you certainly wouldn't bet on a major turnaround from here. I did want to point out in relation to the taking lots of strikes thing, you know, it was Seiya Suzuki who put this issue on our radar insofar as it became, you know, more obvious with him, I think, I would argue, than some others, because he would get in these really deep counts. So it was, you know, he'd seen a lot of pitches in a given at bat, and then all of a sudden he would take a fastball right down the middle for strike three. It was very bizarre. And so that's kind of what teed a lot of this up. And then you see other guys doing the same thing. I did want to note, so for his season so far, a lot of people pointing to the fact that first half of games, he was all universe. Second half, he's been abysmal. You know, the biggest thing that changed, it's not the exclusive change, but it is like so dramatic, is starting with that Pirates series, pitchers just started pounding the zone. Just straight up are like, oh, we just have to throw him strikes? Okay. And his like in zone rate, it just erupted. That was their first scouting shift against him. And he wasn't swinging. So he was behind in a ton of counts. He was taking a lot of strike threes. He wasn't getting those opportunities to create that quality contact. But two things. One, his actual quality of contact during that time was not terrible. It wasn't as good as the first 2 weeks where it was like he was obliterating everything he touched. But it was like fine, playable. There's a lot of bad luck baked into him not getting results. And then two, bit by bit, it's a little early. I don't want to call anything. But his in-zone swing rate has been creeping up. The last four games, it has actually started to reach a level that you would expect it to be at. Whereas he was swinging like 40% of the time at strikes, which is just crazy. And it's been creeping up 60, 70. It was 80 last night. So I don't know. It's possible he's making that adjustment that will play out in the results, but is starting with, okay, they're going to be more aggressive with me, so I've got to be more aggressive with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, we can talk about how the Cubs feel like they're buried in early May. And I tend to agree that I'm not going to be looking for them to make some run here and get back into any sort of playoff race. But I also think there are things that you can watch for to see progress being made. And I know there are a lot of fans that just don't care about that or want to hear that. But while they may be buried in the standings, there are certain players who may be really struggling right now. Suzuki, I'm not too concerned about it. I think he will make that adjustment. I think kind of what you touched on is right. He's seeing more strikes in the zone, and he has to be. It's that fine line, right? You don't want to get over aggressive all of a sudden, but and completely change who you are. But he'll make the adjustments. I trust that. I think he's a pretty talented player, and this will work out in the end for him. But other players, like a guy like Nick Madrigal, it looks bad right now, right? It doesn't look like it's going to work. Well, how much of that is a guy that's trying to, you know, adjust and try, you know, missed how many games with a pretty significant injury, has very little time in the big leagues. Maybe it ends up that he needs to be sent down, right? We touched on this before. Maybe he just needs more time and will be fine and will get back to who he is. And he's one of these guys that we're talking about that's in between, that's a little off, that whose timing is a mess, and he'll be fine, right? I know Cubs fans love to just jump on guys that struggle out of the gate. And they already, I think a lot of fans already made their decision on who Madrigal was before he'd even put on a Cubs uniform, right? That already decided that he stinks. So they weren't even going to give him a chance. And now, you know, a month in, they feel like they're justified. And there's a lot of talk like he's this tremendously awful defender. And I like that feels really unwarranted as well. But that's besides the point. I'm talking about his offense, and I'm curious to see if he can turn things around. And in general, the offense is looking in this really rough in this like stretch since about the Rays series, Pittsburgh series. There, it's been ugly. So I want to see who can develop. And I think there are a couple guys that can turn a corner. I think there's a lot of space on this roster where you're like, yeah, that guy's not going to be around much longer. But there are some younger players or some hidden gems. I mean, Patrick Wisdom, it looks better than I thought he would. But I think he's just going to be one of those guys that's streaky in general. But maybe he has a spot on the roster. We'll see. In the long run, what that means, but I think there are some pieces here that I'm curious to see how they progress over the next few months.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that there are individual performances that matter, and that guys, you know, do have the ability to turn things around. We're not necessarily writing off individual players. It's just like, how do these pieces fit together? And I don't think anyone who's watched the first whatever. 8 or 9 series at this, whatever it is. I mean, it's been, they haven't won a series since the opening series against the Brewers. And it's like at a certain point.
By the way, just I want to slide in with the technically. Remember, one of those games was punted. So you could argue they haven't even won.
That's part of a different series.
Exactly. But no, but that's what I'm trying to enhance your point, Patrick. I'm trying to say. No,
but then if you say that, they haven't won a series all year, well, technically, you know, yeah, it would just be ultimate,
by the way,
comment section.
If you had said that, I would have slid in with the same thing. I would, well, right. They did take 2 of 3.
Well, I mean, I just think, like, in terms of, like, a low point for Cubs management of ownership of being like, hey, trust us on this, guys. Like, this is going to work. It probably will in the long term. That's how the system is set up. And, you know, I think the Cubs farm system is well regarded. They're sitting on tons of money to spend eventually, we think. But like right now, night in and night out, like, you know, I go back to, you know, 2012, the beginning of the Dale Swaim era, and him saying, you know, every team wins 60 games and loses 60 games, and it's what you do in the rest of that time. And it's like the Cubs are in a lot of games. Like, they have elements of, you know, successful teams, and they have, you know, individual talents, but like piecing this together from one night to the next, from one series to the next, I just don't see like where the momentum is going to come from, especially when the starting pitching just hasn't lived up to what you would have hoped. And like, I was down the Baseball Reference rabbit hole last night, and like, that 2012 Cubs team had some pretty good starting pitchers, and I think you would take that group over this one, and they lost 101 games.
Yeah, but they didn't have Wade Miley on the shelf ready to come back and save the day. No, I kid. But in all seriousness, I mentioned that just here as we're wrapping up, because Miley is finally going out on a rehab assignment started today, Thursday, with the Iowa Cubs. And I think we'll get a sense after that appearance for when he might return. And I think what's interesting about him coming back is, by the time he does actually make his Cubs debut, will the conversation about him already be, hey, could he turn himself into a nice trade piece by July?
Yeah.
Instead of what we would have hoped back in spring training when he was delayed, which is, all right, can the Cubs keep the rotation afloat? And then he comes back and he helps, keep them in contention when he comes back. It was predictable, but it's also kind of crazy that, like, by the time he debuts, he's already a trade piece. That's a bummer. Hey, the Myrtle Beach Pelicans scored 24 runs.
Yeah, I was about to say, how about those Pelican guys?
I joked in response to that. I'm like, man, the Cubs are going to be so good in 3 years. I mean, and it's like one of those jokes that's like, the joke is both that I'm not sure it's going to be that long. And I'm also not sure that you can exactly say, like, this group will be with the big league team in 3 years and they'll be great. But it does have a touch of, there's a touch of truth in it that it's like the best concentration of talent in the organization is on this team that puts up a 24 spot. And they're just crushing that league, by the way. They have the best record in the league by quite a stretch. So, I mean, if you do want to be... If the farm system was your bag coming into the season, you're like, well, big league team's going to suck, but I'm really hoping things go good on the farm. By and large, it's gone pretty well. So there you go. There's the hopeful note to close this. And on a less hopeful note, now the Cubs get to play the Dodgers. So cheers. Have a great weekend, everyone. All right. I'm Brett Taylor. This is Odd to Waveland. You can get my stuff at Bleacher Nation. That's Patrick Mooney and Sadhav Sharma. Get theirs at The Athletic. We will be back to you after that Dodgers series. And maybe the Cubs will have given us something surprising to dig into. You never know. So take care, all. Have a good weekend.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.